At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome Mark Clifford, the author of Today Hong Kong, Tomorrow the World, What China's Crackdown Reveals About Its Plans to End Freedom Everywhere. Mark is a veteran journalist, many, many years in Hong Kong, various publications, the South China Morning Post, and then as a director of the Apple Daily publication. We are now looking at how did we get to a city that is that's had its spirit crushed by the People's Republic of China's bully boys. And we begin with a quote that Mark gives in his chapter about how we got here. This is from the distinguished scholar Perry Ling. The Chinese government's censorial authority in recent times has resembled not so much a man-eating tiger or fire-snorting dragon as a giant anaconda coiled in an overhead chandelier. Mark, congratulations and good evening to you. I ask you to explain that anaconda in the chandelier above us. How does that sit on the people of Hong Kong then and now? Good evening to you.
Well, good evening, John, and thanks, of course, for your interest. Well, Perry Link was talking about trying to explain the puzzle of how visitors to China would see well-stocked supermarkets, luxury department stores, and contrasting that with the old Soviet Union, where there was never anything and people looked really beaten down. And in China, people, to outward appearances, look like they're having kind of, you know, middle class lives, especially in the city without a lot of oppression. But the Chinese, he compared it to the anaconda. The rest of the quote goes on to talk about guests at a cocktail party. It's an elegant party. Everyone's well-dressed. They're enjoying their champagne. But they all know that anaconda is up there in the chandelier. And the anaconda doesn't really need to do a lot. But every once in a while, it reaches out and more or less at random just grabs someone and kills them. And I think that's a really great analogy for China and also for Hong Kong. Most of the time, by all appearances, for particularly Western visitors who don't know China well, can go and think it could look like, you know, many other Asian cities. And what's the problem? What's the difference between Japan and China, for example? But I think Perry's point is that this is a very, very dangerous anaconda that's up there in the chandelier. It will and it does destroy people and destroy cities, as it's done with Hong Kong.
It is 2014. Who is Benny Tai and what is Occupy Central, Mark?
Benny Tai is a mild-mannered, was a professor until he lost his job at the University of Hong Kong. He was a law professor, and he was committed to using legal processes to try to get political change in Hong Kong. And we need to remember that when China took over from Britain, took over the colony of Hong Kong in 1997, it made many promises to the people of Hong Kong, who were understandably skittish about being taken over by a communist regime that 8 years earlier in 1989 had slaughtered hundreds of students and pro-democracy protesters in and around Tiananmen Square in Beijing. So Beijing, China wanted to keep Hong Kong happy. It made promises that the existing way of life, the freedoms that Hong Kong people enjoyed, would remain unchanged for 50 years. And not only would freedoms exist, but it would be even better, even more democratic. You know, Hong Kong people would be rulers in their own house. The nasty British colonial oppressors would be gone. Hong Kong people would have the right to universal suffrage. They could elect their own city council, their own mayor. I mean, this was great stuff. Unfortunately, the anaconda in the chandelier had absolutely no intention of carrying through on those promises. I think the Chinese may have deluded themselves into thinking that the Hong Kong people would like the idea of being ruled by China so much that they'd go along with the Chinese Communist Party. Not the case. Hong Kong people consistently have voted for pro-democracy candidates. And by 2014, so getting on to two decades after China took over Hong Kong from colonial Britain, the people of Hong Kong were really getting fed up. And Benny Tai came up with an idea that a massive campaign of civil disobedience would help push China to keep its promises, again, to keep the promises it made that the Hong Kong people could elect their own mayor and their own city council and enjoy the freedoms they always had. And that led to, you know, an unbelievable popular demonstration where the streets of downtown Hong Kong were occupied for 79 days by protesters.
79 days leading to violence. Tear gas in September of 2014. Did that surprise you and your colleagues, Mark?
Well, I think it surprised everybody, including Benny Tai, because, as I said, Benny Tai was a mild-mannered law professor who was great at writing newspaper articles and thinking of innovative strategies of civil disobedience. But I don't think Benny Tai ever thought this was really going to go anywhere. And he was very polite, and it was going to be an Occupy movement that wasn't going to inconvenience anyone, so it was going to be more symbolic than anything else. But times had changed, and a new generation of Hong Kongers who were born around the time of the 1997 handovers took to the streets. So Benny had basically given up and more or less surrendered. But the students coming back to campus in the autumn of 2014 started a student strike. Again, it didn't seem like it was amounting to much. And then at the end of September, had a demonstration outside the city council, the government buildings, and ended up led by a 15-year-old high school student, Joshua Wong, stormed the gates, actually went over the fence, a handful of them, I think fewer than a dozen, occupied a small area, ironically called Civic Square, which was supposed to be a place for, like Hyde Park, where people could exercise free speech. One thing led to another. Tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people rallied in support of the imprisoned Joshua Wong, and the event snowballed. The police panicked and fired off 87 rounds of tear gas. Compared to what came later, this was nothing. But it was the first time that tear gas had been used against Hong Kong people since the handover to China. So this, in turn, just inflamed people and led to this extraordinary takeover that was, I would say, the biggest frontal challenge to the Chinese Communist Party since 1949, with the exception of those 1989 pro-democracy protests. This was a big deal. This was an international financial capital that was, you know, had major sections of it. It wasn't just downtown Hong Kong. There were a couple other areas in the city, Mong Kok, Causeway Bay, that were also occupied. And there were tent cities. Everybody was well behaved. They were singing. They were having teach-ins. Kids were doing their homework.
Yellow umbrellas.
Well, the umbrella, that's where the umbrella movement came. Notion came from. There was that first night, that Sunday night at the end of September, when the 87 rounds of tear gas were fired. People were shocked. I mean, they weren't prepared to be attacked by their own policemen when they were peacefully protesting. And one protester was photographed holding an umbrella, vainly trying to protect himself against tear gas with an umbrella. Doesn't work, but that was the photo. That was the iconic photo that became became known as the Umbrella Uprising, the Occupy Central.
Tsai Wai-lung is the mayor or the leader of or the administrator of Hong Kong at the time, but he works for Beijing. And you take us to a luncheon in January of 2015. Jimmy Lai, who was Jimmy Lai, and how is it that he regretted the protests hadn't been larger? What was his thinking at the time?
Jimmy Lai was an extraordinary entrepreneur who, like many Hong Kongers, was born in China. The family was ripped apart by the Maoist revolution, the Communist revolution of 1949. Jimmy had been born a couple of years earlier, in 1947. And at the age of 12, so 1959, 1960, he smuggled himself in on a small fishing boat into Hong Kong, started working in a garment factory, taught himself English by reading a dictionary, and like thousands of other Hong Kongers, made it good. Really made it good. Became a businessman, first had a textile factory, was making sweaters, a partnership, in fact, with a mainland Chinese organization, which, given his later opposition to the regime, I think shows the fact that this guy is not anti-Chinese. He's very pro-Chinese, but he's anti-communist. And he then started a clothing chain, the Giordano retail stores, very successful. But after the killings in 1989 in Tiananmen, he got so mad that he started a magazine to oppose the Chinese communist regime. That was so successful, he started a newspaper, and he became one of the most important, if not the most important, media magnates in the Chinese speaking world. I mean, anywhere in East Asia.
Apple Daily.
Well, first it was Next Magazine, and the company was Next Digital. Then it was Apple Daily, and it had nothing to do with Apple Computer. Apple Computer was a small, struggling computer company trying to fight for survival in the 1990s when Jimmy started. But Jimmy converted to Catholicism in the 1990s, and he said he looked at the biblical apple, and he said, Eve ate the apple, and then there was news. And without that apple, there wouldn't have been any news. So his idea was to bring people the news of democracy. And he knew that other media people were pulling back because they were afraid of the Chinese. And he went ahead full steam.
He regretted that the protests weren't larger. Is that correct? In January 15th?
Yes. He regretted that they failed. So 2015, he was somebody that I met in the early 1990s when I moved to Hong Kong. And I saw him from time to time, and we were having a lunch just after the failure of Occupy Central. I say it's a failure. I thought it was a success, and that's what I said. But after 79 days, the demonstrators packed up and went home, and they went home empty-handed. The chief executive you alluded to, C.Y. Leung, the mayor of Hong Kong, refused to negotiate, refused to give Hong Kong people the promises that Beijing had made in terms of universal suffrage. And I think the movement was at a bit of a standstill. Here they'd occupied the city for 79 days, unbelievable, hundreds of thousands of people out in the streets, and they came away empty-handed. And Jimmy was so discouraged. He has always been a man of nonviolence, very, very principled stance on nonviolence. But this was nonviolent. It was huge. It was like really almost nothing the world's ever seen. And it didn't get any result. Right. I felt that it was successful because it spoke truth to power. It showed what Hong Kong people thought. And but Jimmy felt it was a failure.
Mark Clifford, the author of Today Hong Kong, Tomorrow the World. When we come back, the backstory of Hong Kong today. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.